pastor, Mr. Randy Stiver.
Thank you, Michael, and greetings, everybody, including those of you who are on the cell phone connections here. Well, I'll give you just a couple of quick updates before we get into the sermon. We haven't sold our house yet. We haven't had anybody interested in coming to look and think about telling us that they don't want to buy our house for a long time. So we would appreciate your continued prayers in that regard. We're busy with a lot of things that are going on. Obviously, you are aware of Andy Deemer's tragedy and the family and the death of his daughter. And I'll be doing the funeral for her tomorrow afternoon. This evening, we have a baptism up at John and Susan Miller's house. One of the, well, I don't know if you've met Steve Sobitz, but Steve grew up in the church and then went to, well, up into his mid-teens and then came back into the church. Quite a few years later, and so he's ready to be baptized. So that's an exciting day in the Sobitz clan, and we're looking forward to that. Then we'll stay over at the Millers tonight and be there for the visitation and the funeral tomorrow. Other than that, lest I forget to say it at the end of the message, I do want to wish everybody a really happy Feast of Tabernacles, Day of Atonement as well, but it goes by so fast. Tabernacles last for a week. That was the word play. Goes by fast. It is a fast. Oh, well. Haven't you clued them in, Michael? Okay. Not to worry. Anyway, Amanda sends her greetings and happy feast wishes as well. She'll be, you know, traveling more with us after the feast. Not every time, but as soon as we're moved up here, of course, more often than. And she's looking forward to that. To start the sermon today, since it's, you know, trumpet or atonement is coming up, I thought it would be good to get us in mind of its meaning. One sermon on the significance of the Day of Atonement, on the Day of Atonement, doesn't really capture everything that that day pictures, and so I'm going to cover part of that in this, and I think you will find it interesting and maybe very practical and applicable. Certainly applies to our modern era. Do you remember it was made into a movie, but it was a stage play to begin with. If I Were a Rich Man is one of the songs, and the name has escaped me again. Fiddler on the Roof. That's right. Dangerous practice. Don't fiddle on the roof, you know. Don't try this at home. Get on the deck at least, so it's flat. But Fiddler on the Roof. Now, I'm not thinking of the scene of the Fiddler on the Roof itself, but of the scene later in the play or the movie where there's a wedding. And then after the wedding, they do a lot of dancing and celebrating, and they do that Cossack, the bottle dance, you know, balance a bottle on their head, the men do it, get down low, and then they're snapping their one leg and after the other out in front of them while they're squatted down on the other leg. It's a scary dance, but they manage to pull it off pretty nicely. It takes serious muscle control in your thighs to be able to do that. Anyway, the rabbi is there. Of course, he's the minister of the Jewish community. And so they're asking him about for blessing of this and blessing that. You know, what prayer of blessing would you use for this or that? And so he's rattling them off because he had blessed the young couple that got married and so on. So finally, somebody's going to stump the rabbi. So he comes up with the ultimate question. Bear in mind, they're Russian Jews. They live in Russia just prior to when the communists take over. They're going from horrifying conditions to equally horrifying conditions. That's the plight of Jews in Russia. The Russians never change if they're communists or if they're under the Tsar. The government doesn't change. It's just as bloodthirsty and deadly and intolerant one way as it is the other. And, you know, that hasn't even changed down to now. You know, democracy didn't really help a lot for them. So the Tsar is in power, which is based on the word for Caesar, and thus it means the king. So the question is brought to the rabbi. He says, is there a proper blessing for the Tsar? And the rabbi is stumped for a moment, but only a moment, because he pulls on his, tugs on his beard. Then his eyes brighten up, and he says, "Yes, God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us." Which unfortunately isn't able to happen because, as you know, the story as it presses on. And as the Tsar is not being able to be kept away, they're getting swept into the communist revolution of 1917, the Bolshevik revolution. And like I said, it goes from worse to worse, but at least Russia's constant. God bless and keep the Tsar far away from us. But I have another question. Is, and this is the title of the sermon, is there a prayer for the devil? Not a proper blessing, but I'm going to use the concept that the blessing was a prayer. Is there a prayer for the devil? Now let's look at some of the significance of the Day of Atonement. You know, in overview, we know that the Day of Atonement pictures the end of Satan's domination over mankind. It also has other layers of meaning. Each of the holy day seasons do. And to milk them of every bit of it takes a lot of messages. And then you stop and think, well, I forgot to cover this. And what about this? There's so many things. But we're going to look at a couple of aspects of the Day of Atonement. First of all, let's look at one of the meanings that comes out of Leviticus 25. Obviously, it is listed as an annual Sabbath and therefore an annual feast day in two chapters earlier in chapter 23, but that will get read, I'm sure, on the Day of Atonement. So we'll look at chapter 25, Leviticus 25. Not everybody takes well to fasting. You know, people get headaches. Blood sugar crashes, all kinds of things. And so you wonder, I wonder how the Levites fared on the Day of Atonement, especially those in the priesthood. You know, obviously they always had lots of things that had to be done. Even though it was a fast day, there were sacrifices, a whole regimen of sacrifices that had to be offered, which meant, slaughtering the animals, stacking the wood, lighting the fires, all those things that had to be done. And presumably the cleanup, we never stop to think about the cleanup of the burnt offerings, and presumably the cleanup that would follow as we put things back in order, preparation for the coming day. But here's something else that occurs. In chapter 25, we have the reference to the land Sabbath in the first seven verses, or the Sabbath, the sabbatical year is another term. This is where educational circles, where they send a professor on a sabbatical. They're borrowing it, right? That term right here out of the first seven verses. And they figure you teach for 7 years, you need to go get some education for a year. Theoretically, we never did that in a church. That'd be nice. Well, we did. Now I'll take that back. We did do that for a bright and shining moment in the 1970s, because I had a pastor I trained under, and when he was transferred from the area, he was transferred to headquarters in Pasadena at the time for a sabbatical. He attended a lot of the advanced Bible classes, and he profited from it quite considerably. There were other men in there too, and so everybody was beginning to look forward to their sabbatical year, because it really is a way to invest a lot of added time and study and reflection and education. And then your well is full again and you're ready to go and pump it back out in teaching the brethren. But that was just for a few years that we did that. Later we replaced it with a ministerial refresher program, which once every 3 years, 3 to 4 years, we got to come in for 2 weeks. Well, okay, it was better than nothing, but you got 2 weeks of instruction, and you had a span of 3 years between them compared to 7 years of teaching and a whole 9-month school year of learning. It was a lot smaller. It was beneficial, but a full sabbatical probably would really be a benefit to the church. And in the world tomorrow, we can do that, you know. But the land Sabbath occurred every seventh year. And if you stop and think about it, that cycle is critical to understand. The third tithe year, just as an aside, the third tithe year was every third year. But it was every third year in a seven-year cycle. So you count 1, 2, 3, third tithe year, 4, 5, 6, third tithe year, land Sabbath. Then you start over, 1, 2, 3. So it isn't actually every third year. It's the third year and sixth year in a seven-year cycle. Otherwise, you know, why would it be that way? Why is it 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3? I like waltzes. Well, if you keep counting your land Sabbaths and you come to the third one, then you have, if you didn't have it in the year 3 and the year 6 of the seven-year cycle, the 21st year you would have everybody in a third tithe year on a land Sabbath year. And so then there is no third tithe to speak of, which was essentially the welfare fund of Israel. So it has to be within the cycle. So it's in the seven-year cycle. So you have the seven-year cycle, but it is a part of another cycle itself, or is the core. That's the Jubilee cycle. And the Jubilee cycle is the 50th year. So you have seven land Sabbaths, counting them off, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 land Sabbaths, dittos, 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 till you come to the 49th year. That's a land Sabbath, and it is immediately followed by Jubilee. So Jubilee, as it turns out, when you read all the regulations, is also a land Sabbath, a double land Sabbath, and a remarkable time. And at the end of every 7 years, it's not just a land Sabbath. That's the benefit, the fertility of the soil and education of the people. Think of all the public works things that could be done when you have people not completely involved in their agricultural pursuits. They would have more time for other things that need to be looked after. But the added benefit then of the Jubilee is that at the end of the 7 years, you have really a seriously larger amount of time for learning as well. Now, the land Sabbath was also a time of the year of release. So certain debts that a person owed disappeared in the seventh year. They were just gone. And we say, wow, that sounds like our bankruptcy laws. It's what they're modeled after. They aren't on a sequence like that. They would probably be better if they were. But they're modeled on the principle of forgiving debt. The land Sabbath the Jubilee year, the 50th year, was a year of the release of slaves and the release of, in particular, land. You could not sell land in perpetuity. It would come back to your family in the 50th year. So it was only on a lease until the Jubilee, and then it came back. So usually it wasn't the generation that put it into the lease, they got it back, it was their children or their grandchildren. But suddenly here comes this wealth of the land back into their lap on the Jubilee, and so then they get to decide what they're going to do with it, and it'll be a benefit. It's the rhythm and the cycle that God intended for society economically as well as spiritually. You know, we get to share in parts of it. But needless to say, the land comes back. I always like to go back to South Dakota, visit our family farm. Although it was not the family farm my father grew up on, he grew up in Nebraska on a homestead, but he wasn't able to purchase the property later when we grew up, which is why we moved to South Dakota near the Black Hills. But my brother and sister and their spouses were able to buy some land, not of the home place, but except for the houses. The house and corral system is all owned by one of my brother's daughters and her husband. So we got that part, and we all can come back there, and we remember all the happy times we had there. But the part that borders the river, it was about 300 acres of pasture, river bottom. By river bottom, not land, our agricultural land, but river breaks, I guess. Gullies filled with juniper trees and cottonwoods and chokecherries and things like that. We hunt there and walk around there, go fishing, hunt rocks, and lots of them down by the river. It's always a joy to go back to those things. And there's a certain freedom to have land. In our family, the part of the joy of the freedom is you could safely shoot a rifle whenever you wanted. And so we would get on a cliff that overlooks this piece of land. And we do this almost every time we're back there. We pick rocks out. A few rocks in the river's not deep. It's the deepest part's about waist deep. So there are rapids, and you have rocks in the rapids. And at 200 yards, you can safely shoot a rock. So we blaze away at rocks, and then we pick out the challenging ones. We go out into the prairie, past the river, where you have a largish rock, by large, that big, out to 400 yards or so. And then we shoot at that. You don't hit that one as often. But you have the freedom of movement and enjoyment. Now, the coming back of the land brought that freedom. And so this is what happened at that time. You shall count seven Sabbaths, verses 8 to 10. Shall count seven Sabbaths of years for yourself, seven times 7 years, and the time of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then, at the end of the 49th year, you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound. And you think, oh, wow, Feast of Trumpets again. No. This is the Day of Atonement. On the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement, you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout your land. And you'll consecrate the 50th year, and it'll be a jubilee to you. And each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you to his family. It is a time of freedom. The trumpet of freedom is what that is. And it's a marvelous time in that sense. But just imagine having the duty of having to go out and blow the shofar or the silver trumpets at length and repeatedly and loudly in the celebration of the freedom. Every Day of Atonement, there were trumpets blown, but on this day, there were lots of trumpets blown because it came every 50th year. You know, try to do that on an empty stomach. And yet some people do. Years ago, we pastored in the Rockford, Illinois congregation. And they had, in 165 members, we had an choir of about 40 voices. And we had an orchestra that numbered between 35 and 40. So you had, when we had a holy day and it was time for special music, we always liked the big production on the holy days. About half the congregation went up to the stage or around the stage and in front of the stage. They couldn't fit all on it. To perform special music while a few of us sat back and enjoyed listening to it and were inspired by it. And I told the elder who was in charge of the choir and the orchestra, I said, you don't have to do the big show for the Day of Atonement. Oh, he says, they want to. They would rather rehearse and sing and play their instruments on the Day of Atonement than not. And the ones that are overhearing me are nodding like this. We do, yes. Okay. So I guess that it is therapeutic at a time like that. So it was a time of freedom. And that's a good thing. I mean, the right kind of freedom. And there's another aspect to it. Let's go back now to chapter 16. Leviticus 16. Here was the ceremony then. You had the blowing of the trumpets, whether the few on the regular atonement day, the more probably on a land Sabbath year, and a whole lot of them on the Jubilee. But every Day of Atonement required all of this effort that was put out. And you go down and through it and read what had to be done. Verse 3, for example, Aaron shall come into the holy place. And the blood of a young bull is a sin offering, and a ram is a burnt offering, and he shall put on the holy linen garments, tunic rather, and the linen trousers on his body, and shall be girded with a linen sash. Now, if this linen sash is the same then as it was in Jeremiah's day, it was actually a kilt. So he had trousers on and a kilt sort of over it, plus a tunic. It wasn't just a sash that went down like this. It went down and wrapped around. These are holy garments. It was a very special uniform, magnificent uniform that Aaron had to put on. Therefore, he shall wash his body in water and put them on. Then he will take, after these other offerings that were mentioned, he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of the goats, so two young goats, as a sin offering and a ram as a burnt offering. And Aaron will offer the bull as a sin offering for himself and make atonement for himself and his house. And that's all mentioned there in verse 6. And on down the line, he goes and through various ceremonies. There's one note I want to bring to your attention, those mentioned in verse 8 to begin with. Then Aaron shall cast lots. Well, verse 7, he shall then take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one for the Lord, so it will be the Lord's goat, and the other for the scapegoat. But in Hebrew, the word is the Azazel goat, A-Z-A-Z-E-L, the Azazel goat. So they're just two goats. So he casts lots. In other words, he's asking God, which one will represent will be the blood sacrifice and which one will be the Azazel? We'll get into the Azazel in a moment. We understand what the first ones, the Lord's goat, would be sacrificed for the sins of Israel. And the choice is made. So in verse 15, then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering. That would be the Lord's goat, that it was an offering for sin. Now granted, in ancient Israel, no sins were forgiven by the blood of bulls and goats and sheep or anything. But the sin was covered, in a sense, temporarily. There will be a time when each of those individuals will have to repent on their own. Israel was not called. They weren't converted. They will come up in the second resurrection, in the great white throne judgment. And the bulk of Israel then will be converted. At that time, it was only the very few, Moses and Aaron, certainly, Joshua, perhaps certain key leaders in among the leadership of Israel at the time, the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, certainly. We don't know about the other patriarchs, but certainly Joseph. Going down through that, you would have all the prophets and certain kings. And certain women, like Deborah, perhaps, Ruth, most certainly, and Miriam, back in the time of this time. There would be a few, but the rest will come up in the great white throne judgment. So they will have their chance to ask God to forgive their sins. So he will kill the kid of the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people, and bring its blood inside the veil and do with the blood as he did with the blood of the bull, sprinkling it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. Now, that means he would go inside the veil into what it was called the Holy of Holies. If you sort of imagined our section of the room here as the temple, and there was a curtain back here behind me for another smaller room, about the third the size of this, what would happen is that the priests would come and go. It all always faced to the east, the doorway opened to the east. And whether it was a tabernacle or later the temple, the proportions and the design was the same. The main room was called the holy place. And that's where you had the tables that held the showbread, which was actual bread that was offered to God. And then it was disposed of, except for that one time when David came running by with several of his men and they were having a real serious blood sugar crash and they were on the run from the forces of Saul. And David said, "Have you anything to eat?" He says, Abiathar said, "I have nothing but the showbread. Here, take it." And Christ cites that as, you know, that was not breaking the commandment in that sense. There was a spirit of the law that was involved. Then the showbread's on the table, the candlestick is there, and there's the altar of burnt offerings is outside the door and off to one side because it's a big fire. You don't have that inside the building. But you do have a fire inside the building, which on cool days would serve as probably a warming, almost like a wood stove. It's the altar of incense. And it was where the priests would come with their censers, which were ladles, ornately designed, beautifully decorated, and probably covered in gold. And it had a ladle or like a dipper on the end. And you'd scoop into the fire and get a hot coal. Then you took a handful of incense from the incense container, if you were a priest. The incense was a blending of special fragrant spices and herbs that was, according to specific recipes for different ones, and those recipes and the production of that seemed to be centered on one family line of the tribe of Levi. They did that for hundreds of years, it appears. They were the ones that guarded the secret of the incense. So they produced that, and the priest would take some, And as he went through the ceremonies that he had to do each day, he would sprinkle that on that hot coal, and it would give off that wonderful fragrance, which in Revelation is referred to, is compared to the prayers of the saints. It's like that's the incense was, in essence, a symbol for our prayers, meaning because we're saints too in this age. So that would be done. And then Aaron would go, that would be taken care of by the other priests. Only the high priest could go into the room that would be behind me here. And that would be the Holy of Holies, or sometimes called the Most Holy Place. In Hebrew, they simply repeat holy twice, holy, holy, which means like the most holy. That's how you make a superlative in Hebrew, is you repeat the word. And if you repeat it three times, I mean, it just went off the charts. It's so amazing. This was the Most Holy Place. So he will take the blood and sprinkle it on the mercy seat. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was in that room. That was the main thing. It was a box covered in gold made of gopher wood. We don't know exactly what gopher wood is, I don't think. Various trees have various names in different times and cultures and languages. But it was covered with gold. And on top of the lid, it had a lid. On top of the lid was a carving of, an image of God's throne, covered in gold as well, maybe even in solid gold. I have to double check that. And then above that were statues of two angels. These were cherubim, or as we would say in English, cherubs, in American English. I say cherub, use this harder sound because a CH in Hebrew comes out as a K. And that's the way it's said in England, which is where I learned about it. So the cherubim stand on either side of God's throne, and their wings overshadow or overspread the throne of God in heaven. That's always done. There are always two of them on duty doing that. Underneath, the great spiritual rainbow that goes up above them. It's got to be a pretty impressive sight. So the mercy seat is then a representation of the throne. So he sprinkles the blood of the Lord's goat on the mercy seat, makes atonement for the holy place, that's the temple itself, and because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, because of their transgressions. So it is a sin offering for the Israelites. And when he's made an end of atoning for the holy place, that's in verse 20, we drop to verse 20, and for the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, then he shall bring the live goat. Oh, now we come to the live goat. Aaron will lay both his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away to the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. So he, if it's a young male goat, he'll probably hook a thumb around each horn to make sure he hangs on to it. And he then confesses over it in a very powerful prayer, the sins of all the Israelites over the past year. And seeming to blame the goat for those sins. In fact, that's what he's doing in symbolically. And then it is sent away into the hand of a suitable man. And the goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities in an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. Now, it says suitable if it's, you know, it says it's a kid, a young goat of a year. I don't know if you've ever broken an animal to lead, where you could put a halter on them and lead them around. Animals don't naturally want to be led around. That's definitely a conditioned response. You pull on the rope, and then they come along with you. And it's really a joy when they come along nicely. But growing up on a farm and a ranch, we had a lot of animals, horses, milk cows, show animals for 4-H and things like that, various other animals that we needed to break to lead, train to lead. And I remember my cousin had she became one of our milk cows, and she was a very fine cow. But when she was a calf, she was his 4-H project, but she didn't want to be led at all. She was friendly. You could walk up and scratch her ears anytime you wanted, put a halter on her, and try to lead Daisy anywhere, and she just set all four brakes. She was not, and then she'd start to back up if she could. So it was my job to get behind her, and he pulled, I would push. And we worked at that for about 3 days on and off until we finally got the idea that when he pulls, she follows. And then after that, it was a piece of cake. So if you have a young goat that is not broke to lead and the suitable man carries and takes the goat out to the uninhabited place, how far away is that going to be? It's going to be outside the environs of the temple or of the tabernacle. And bear in mind, in the days of Moses and Aaron, the tabernacle was smack dab encamped. It was smack dab in the center of all of the Israelites, all of the tribes camped around it. So you had to walk through half of them to get out of the portable city. And if you have 1.2 million adults, because of 600,000 men plus women and children, so you have 1.2 million adults, you're probably going to have a minimum of 1.2 million kids. Probably conservatively 3 million would be a good estimate of the population of the Israelites leaving Egypt. Wow. So you've got to walk through half of 3 million people. That's going to be a ways, even when they're kind of compactly camped there. And then you got to go off and away to an uninhabited place. That's going to be a few more miles. And if you have a goat that doesn't lead, you need a suitable man to do that. Because he's going to have to, you know, when you lead an animal that doesn't lead, that's tricep work if you're doing it one-handed. So he's going to have serious back-of-the-arm type muscles. Or else he's going to have to pick it up and carry it in either case. He needs a suitable man to do it. Now, compare that to Revelation 20. First three verses of Revelation 20. Remember, we're getting down to the key here of what is there a prayer for the devil? After we read Revelation 20, then we're going to talk about what we read back in Leviticus. Chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. John is seeing this in vision. This is at the time of Christ's coming, his second coming. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and put a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more until the 1,000 years were finished. After that, he's going to be released for a little while, a very short time. So here we have an angel with a great chain in his hand. This doesn't sound like a little sort of wimpy angel at all. It sounds like a suitable angel to the task, because he is going to take one of his former peers and put him in prison. And it doesn't say who it is. Maybe it's Michael, though, that has the honor to do this. It would be an honor to be able to do that. I'm just guessing. We only know three angels' names. We know Michael, who's an archangel and is the guardian angel of the church in the end of the age. We know Gabriel, who was a messenger angel that went to Daniel, that went to Joseph and Mary. And then we know Lucifer, whose name got a name changed to Satan and devil. So he has three names, you know. But those are the only angels we know the names of. All the angels have names, and there are billions of them. And we'll get to know them in due course, but not today. You see the parallel of the Azazel goat with the sins of the Israelites confessed upon it. In other words, it carries the blame of their sins. But instead of being sacrificed for a sin offering, it is hauled away by a suitable man into the wilderness and released in an uninhabited place. Satan is taken into a place where he and the demons are all restrained, and a seal is set on them. They aren't killed; they're immortal. So they're going to suffer the consequences of their actions for eternity. The fate of humans' immortal souls, according to traditional Christian doctrine, is actually more or less the fate of the demonic spirits. Satan has foisted off what's going to happen to him and making man think it's going to happen to him. And so you have an ever-burning hell fire is needed for that. So you see, that's where the doctrine of the ever-burning hell fire comes from. So here we have Satan being blamed and taking his blame and being placed away from the presence of man and of God, initially for 1,000 years and then forever. as the rest of the chapter unfolds. So we have a lesson. Remember the Azazel goat, the one that is representative of Satan. Traditional Christianity normally thinks that that's actually another representation of Christ. You have the Lord's goat, and then you have the Lord's non-Lord's goat. That doesn't make sense. You know, you had a specific drawing. One would be one thing and one the other. And they say, well, the Lord's goat forgives our sins. The Azazel goat removes our sins from us. Oh, they weren't removed when they were forgiven? Well, let me explain that again. And then they just repeat what they said. No, they don't understand the Azazel. They do not see Satan in the Azazel goat. There are a very few of traditional Christians who do recognize, very few, almost all think it's forgive and remove. And that's how they explain it. But it's not the explanation. The explanation is the Azazel goat represents Satan. And he is a partner in our sins. Thus, he has to have that placed, the guilt placed firmly where it belongs. You know, back in Leviticus 20, verse 21 of chapter 16, Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the goat and confess over it the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The other goat was the Lord's goat, and its blood was shed, representing the forgiveness of those sins. So there's another culpability of the sins of the Israelites. The accomplice, who isn't more than an accomplice. He's the great mob leader in that sense. So what is there a prayer for the devil? The answer is yes, that was it. Aaron confessed the sins of the Israelites on the Azazel goat. So it carried, that was the prayer for the devil. And there is a name for that kind of prayer. It's called an imprecatory prayer. It is not a prayer of, oh God, please bless the devil who is represented by this goat. No, it's not a blessing at all. It is a precatory prayer, is a prayer against evil. And that evil would get what it has coming and be removed completely from existence, ultimately. Needless to say, the tone and confession of the prayer over the Azazel goat would be different with regards to the sins of Israel as it would have been on the Lord's goat. Because it was addressing the evil power behind those sins, the one who instigated it from the beginning. There is a religious commentator or blogger, his name is Doug Giles, G-I-L-E-S. This is from a few years ago that he wrote. But he called it imprecatory prayer, the intercessor's elephant gun. And, you know, well, elephant gun? What's an elephant gun? Well, what's an elephant? Well, I don't know. It's this big animal. Big is right. Stands 11 feet tall. It weighs up to 6 tons or more. It can travel 9 to 12 miles an hour. Well, I can outrun that. You can for a few hundred yards, but the elephant can go like that for all day. And he doesn't have to get all the way up with you. He'll just grab you with the trunk and throw you over the baobab tree and then come around and stomp you with those massive ash can or trash can size feet of his. So, if you want to be protected from a rogue elephant that's in a bad mood, you don't use a pea shooter. You use an elephant gun because it's big compared to other guns. And probably knock you down when you pull the trigger because it's got such recoil. So the intercessor's elephant gun is what an imprecatory prayer is. It is a prayer against evil. The way this guy puts it and defines it, and he's pretty much spot on, is asking God to crush a clear enemy of his, an enemy which is an aggressive adversary of freedom and peace-loving people. You use the imprecatory prayer. We don't always pray an imprecatory prayer, but there are times when that needs to be a part of our prayers. The imprecatory prayer. Now, let's look at a couple of examples, actually several, of David's in Psalm 58 to begin with. Psalm 58. David was really good at the imprecatory prayer. But then again, he was really good at all his prayers and setting them to music as well. You know, in Samuel, it refers to David as the sweet psalmist of Israel, sort of an obituary comment about him after he died. Well, there were times when the sweetness of his psaltery, the writing of psalms, the sweetness was set aside and the sword was pulled out. And it took on a different tone. Let me give you a couple of these several examples. Notice that the superscription, this is just before you get into the first line of the poem, or of the psalm, "Do you indeed speak righteousness, you silent ones?" Notice that it is set to a particular sound, music of a tune that was known in David's day. "Do not destroy" is the name of the tune. Well, all right, "do not destroy." The wicked, in verse 3, "are estranged from the womb. They go astray as soon as they are born, speaking lies. Their poison is like the poison of a serpent. They are like the deaf cobra that stops its ear and will not heed this voice of charmers, charming ever so skillfully." And then he asked God to deal with people who are like this deadly cobra. "Break their teeth in their mouth, O God. Break out the fangs of the young lions. Let them flow away as waters which run continually." You ever talk to somebody who is in an accident, had his teeth broken out, whether from a fight or one guy I remember was a logger. I think he caught a bolt, came back, that his chainsaw. Somehow there was a bolt in the brush next to the tree, and the chainsaw blade flicked it right back into his front teeth. And he was spitting out teeth when he came to. Another example, he lost more than a few teeth. He had another close brush with danger in the woods. Now, so God, David says, "Break their teeth in their mouth. Break out the fangs of the young lions." Nothing against lions. He's actually comparing young lions as a term for young warriors. "Let them flow away as waters which run continually. When he bends his bow," the enemy, "let his arrows be as if cut in pieces. Let them be like a snail which melts away as it goes, like a stillborn child of a woman that they may not see the sun." Boy, the imagery of bad archery is really powerful here. I don't know if you've ever shot an arrow that disintegrated when you released it. I have. We experimented with things like that as a kid, but we had little weenie bows then that would pull maybe 10 or 15 pounds. But the other day I had an arrow with my hunting bow and I was out in the backyard practicing and I shot it and it disappeared. Didn't go anywhere to the target, but I caught a glimpse of movement left and right. And I thought, what in the world? So I went over and found the pieces. It had a crack in it that I hadn't noticed. And then when the pressure was put on by the string from a heavy bow, it just popped it and it sailed away harmlessly to the left and the right. So David wanted their arrows of the wicked to just fall into pieces where they couldn't defend themselves or attack anybody. Or be like a snail. They release it from their big battle bows, and instead of going away as a deadly missile, it just crawls through the air and finally melts away in the sun. More like a slug. The slug is a snail without a shell, and the way we would hunt slugs in the Northwest was with a salt shaker. You find a slug, you put salt on him, he's done. Go find another one, and they proliferate very quickly, and they eat all your garden, so you have to control numbers. But this is an imprecatory section here. He's talking about evil men, and certainly it would be applicable to the instigator of the evil men as well. Let's go to Psalm 69 now, look at another example. Psalm 69. Oh, I love the superscription on this one. "To the chief musician, set to the lilies." So there was some song named after this, the lilies, you know, the little flowers of the lilies. So it's got to be an interesting song to have it set to that. Although the words all seem wrong for a song that is, you can, how would that sound? We don't know. we'll wait till the millennium and David can play it for us. And we said, oh, now I get it. But not right now. But it's obviously different because notice the first verse. Save me, O God, for the waters have come up to my neck. I sink in deep mire. There is no standing. I have come into deep. He's drowning. He's about to drown, and he's praying for God's intervention, and you call that the lilies? Well, that's the tune he picked. But it goes on, and it gets more serious than that. We'll go down to verse 24. This is, it's an adventure of a trial or a trouble that he's facing, and sometime just maybe this Sabbath or tomorrow, just in the morning, just sit there and read this and try to picture some of circumstance David might have been feeling or experiencing. Well, verse 24 is the section I want to borrow, but the preceding verses carry the same thing. The key is that David, in verse 17, is in trouble. He's in trouble, being pursued by his enemies. I think he probably dreamed about being chased by Saul's men. Because David was always on the lam for quite a few years prior to the death of Saul. He was always running and hiding and running and hiding. And, it, you know, when you, after a while, it unnerves you. Even though, you know, he was a great warrior and he was surrounded by his merry men who became mighty men. You know, they were phenomenal warriors in their own right, but they were seriously outnumbered by some pretty powerful Israelites. So David is praying about this. Verse 24, pour out your indignation upon them, and let your wrathful anger take hold of them. Let their dwelling place be desolate, and no one live in their tents. Dwelling place be desolate. That sounds like something you've read before. It is. The Apostle Peter applied that to Judas Iscariot, that line, in Acts chapter 1 and verse 20. He was inspired to take that line out of the psalm and apply it to Judas as they were getting ready to select a replacement for him among the 12. For they persecute the ones that you have struck and talk of the grief that you have wounded. Add iniquity to their iniquity. Let them not come into your righteousness. Let them be blotted out of the book of the living and not be written with the righteous. So we see here David did not mince words when he was dealing with evil forces arrayed against him. David understood the backing of those evil forces because at one time it co-opted him, much later in his life when he was king and he decided to number Israel. And even Joab, his highly political maneuvering general, said, don't do that. God doesn't want you to do that. Like Joab would know what God wants, but he did know that. And David said, no, I want to know. About, I want to know how many Israelites that I have under me. And God was not pleased. Satan had instigated that idea into David's mind, and David acted on it. Now, why that's memorable, because God gave him a choice. He said, okay, David, punishment time. You know, you wanted punishment, but here's the punishment. You make the choice. For 3 years, you can run from your enemies. No, sorry. For 3 years, you can have famine. Or for 3 months, you can run from your enemies and be defeated at every engagement. Or for 3 days, you can have a plague in the country. And David chose the plague because it was 3 days. Well, when 70,000 people died in Jerusalem alone, then David is imploring God to have mercy and stop it. And God says, all right, you're going to have to make an offering. It needs to be on a high place here where it will be an important place. And David looked up and there was the sword of one of the angels. Sometimes you can see angels when God lets you. And David could see him. And he was standing at the threshing floor of Ornan, who was a Jebusite. Obviously a friendly Jebusite, because it was Jebusites who owned Jerusalem before. And so David marched up there and said, I would like to buy your threshing floor. And Ornan said, well, great king, you can have it. and here's my oxen for the sacrifice. And he said, because David explained he needed to make an offering there. He says, no, I'll pay the price for it. And so he did, and then they made the offering, and the plague was stopped because of that. That became the temple site. That's where the temple was placed. And that was how it came about. So David then is asking God to intervene and strike these evil ones in a powerful way. Like I said, he got co-opted once himself. He understood that Satan could do. And so he understood the importance of an imprecatory prayer. Now, Psalm 139, as there are many more that we could find, not the whole psalm, but elements. The Psalm 139 is particularly interesting in the contrast, study of contrasts. Again, it is one of David's psalms. Right at the top, the superscription said so. And it starts off in a positive tone. Let me give you the sense of it, and then we'll come to the kicker at the end. You have searched me, and Lord, you have searched me, and had known me. You know my sitting down and my rising up. You understand my thought afar off. You comprehend my path and my lying down, and you're acquainted with my ways. And in verse 5, you have hedged me behind and before, and you laid your hand on me. Verse 7, where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, like meaning the grave, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me. In verse 13, for you formed my inward parts. You covered me with my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your eyes, in verse 16, saw my substance as being yet unformed. God read his chromosome. He knew what he would look like and what he was going to be like in many ways. How precious are your thoughts to me, O Lord, O God. Now, the word precious, we use that as the super soft word. How precious, you know, with this precious way of saying precious. So think about that. We're exaggerating slightly here because David wouldn't say it like that. But how precious also are your thoughts, O God. How great is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would be more in number than the sand. And when I awake, I'll still be with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God, and depart from me, therefore, you bloodthirsty men. For they speak against you, meaning God, wickedly. Your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate them, O Lord, who hate you? Do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with a perfect hatred. I count them as my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart, and try me and know my anxieties, and see if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. What was the explosion about? That's the imprecatory section. I hate them with a perfect hatred. He hates evil. And, you know, in the sense, you hate the fact that people have chosen to be evil. And you want that rooted out. You want evil gone. But we know who the source of the evil is. It's the devil. That's the one who instigates it. Some people copy it. Some people make a habit of it. Some cultures are habitually evil in their behaviors. And those are the times when imprecatory prayers are needed. You know, we don't hate our enemies. We love our enemies, our real enemies. We pray for them. And I don't mean by real enemies, I don't mean those who have just inconvenienced us or insulted us or, you know, shunned us or, you know, made us feel silly, stupid, or unappreciated. Those are not your real enemies. Those are just irritating people that you love. Sometimes because you have to, but you know that other times it's not just because you have to. But the point is, evil must not be sugar-coated in our mind. Evil is terrible and nasty and evil. And David has made that clear. Evil must be denounced. Otherwise, we start to entertain evil. And we begin to think, well, maybe they're not that bad. I mean, you know, Well, she didn't really need her head, did she? Well, you see how that goes, though? We live in a society that is making excuses for very, very evil people. Very evil. It is a culture of evil. And the only way to deal with that culture will be for it to be wiped out completely. And then you start from scratch. And the ones you wiped out, you're going to pick that up with them, you know, with the second resurrection. And that's another day of reckoning, is that second resurrection. Let me give you an example. The Apostle Paul was a little bit like King David. Let's go back to 2 Timothy chapter 4. When King David was dying, he was, you know, on his last legs, and he almost died, and then he got better, and then he realized, oh, there's a coup d'etat going on. Adonijah was one of his sons, a brother of Absalom, was trying to become king, and he was being assisted by Joab, his commander, as well as by one of the high priests. And so Nathan the prophet and Bathsheba brought it to his attention, and I said, bring Solomon in. So then he made Solomon king. And then Solomon was co-regent with King David for a period of time. We don't know how long, but probably barely months, because his health was failing in his 70th year. And so he called Solomon in. He said, now you, Solomon, you know Joab. You know him. And you know how to deal with him. In other words, you know what he did, how he supported Adonijah. Now you deal with him wisely, is what he told Solomon. Solomon knew what his dad meant. He was wise, as a young man even. And he said, your brother Adonijah, who's a half-brother to Solomon, he said, you know what he did. Because when King David named Solomon as the king and Adonijah heard about it, then he came groveling to save his life, and David spared his life. But when he got closer to death, he told Solomon, you deal with him. And Abiathar cannot be high priest any longer. Zadok is going to be the high priest. And Solomon understood that. And that's why you had Sadducees at the time of Christ. They're not really sad, you see. They're named after Zadok, or Saduk, depending on how it's pronounced, what accent's on it. And then there was Shimei. Remember when Absalom had a coup d'etat and took over the government? Shimei was a Benjamite that hated King David, and so he's throwing rocks at him and cursing at him as David and his men are leaving Jerusalem so that the whole of Jerusalem wouldn't be slaughtered by his idiot son Absalom. And he said, you take care of Shimei. Now, why would David say that? Did he turn vindictive? No. He understood those men. He knew that evil still lurked in their hearts. In a way, David was kind of like the shadow. The shadow knows the evil that lurks in the human heart. So did Paul, as we see here in 2 Timothy chapter 4. This is Paul's last will and Saul, Paul, all right, both names are his. His last will and testament, in a sense, his last advice. Notice, we'll just read in verse 9. Be diligent to come to me quickly, addressing Timothy, for Demas has forsaken me and loved this present world and has departed for Thessalonica. Crescens for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia. Only Luke is with me. Now, it seems like Demas has walked away from the faith, but Crescens and Titus probably went to where they needed to teach. Galatia would be central Turkey today. Dalmatia is what we would call Romania today. Only Luke is with me. So get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry. Wow. There was a time when the Apostle Paul didn't want anything to do with John Mark. And now he says he's necessary. I need him here. And Tychicus, I left at Ephesus, and bring the cloak I left with Carpus at Troas when you come, and the books, especially the parchments. And you think, the books, the parchments. Was Paul working on the canon of the New Testament? Very possibly. And it was probably finalized by the time of John by the apostles. Now, they'll say that the Greek church did it. All they had to work with is what the apostles had already done. So here's Paul doing his part of that. And you can see why he needed Mark. Mark was one of the writers of the New Testament. He and Luke. So he needed one of both of them there. Because you've got books and you've got parchments and two of his scholars that can help him. Then we switch in verse 14. Alexander the coppersmith did me much harm. May the Lord repay him according to his works. And you also must beware of him, for he has greatly resisted our words. Alexander the coppersmith was in Ephesus, and he had resisted the Apostle Paul and done a lot of things to stop the work that he was trying to do there. So here Paul is asking God to treat him according to his works. You're not begging for mercy. Mercy isn't needed when its evil is on the line. Well, there'll be a relative measure of mercy, of course. The evil needs to be purged from society and ultimately from the person, and sometimes they need a lot more divine pressure than some people need a lot more divine pressure than others to get rid of the evil out of their lives. So we have to identify evil for what it is. Let's go back to Isaiah 5. We plow through our last few selections here. Isaiah chapter 5. Do not sugarcoat evil. We are in an age of acceptance. And you think, oh, but acceptance is so nice. Right. You accept evil. You accept evil, you'll be destroyed. Because there are plenty of people willingly happy to be accepted by you so they can get close enough to kill you and destroy everything worthwhile that you ever worked on. Woe to those, verse 18, to give a little lead up to it. Verse 18, woe to those who draw iniquity with cords of vanity and sin as if with a cart rope. In other words, you're bringing cartfuls of sin with you and into society. We live in an age where sin is being institutionalized, brought in by the cartload. It is written into the law. 50-some years ago, we had the first sex and drug revolution in the 1960s. The upshot of that is that it institutionalized shacking up, living in sin, living in adultery. The second sexual and drug revolution has been underway for the past few years, past maybe five or six. And look at what it has institutionalized. It has taken it even a step worse and further. And the family, the identity of family, and God's way is the way of family and of marriage, has been eradicated increasingly and vindictively. This sexual revolution is far more militant than the first one. And it was bad enough. It was revolutionary. This one is just mean-spirited and militant. It will get worse. We can expect that. They say, let him speed, verse 19, they say, let him make speed and hasten his work that we may see it. Let the counsel of the Holy One draw near that we may know it. In other words, scoffing at the idea that God even exists. So in verse 20, we come to the real kicker. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And that's what they have done. They've called evil good, and then they have called good, family and marriage, in the way that God defines it, they have called that evil. This is happening right before our eyes. We can't sort of accept it. Oh, it's just the way it is. You know, people are born, they're not born that way. Most of that is to do with lust. Maybe and lust on the part of parents or grandparents, you know, that they've come down through the family culture for a few. Mostly it's just lust. That's where most sin comes from in one way or the other, especially sexual sins. So we have to be clear. We believe in Sabbath keeping. We believe in sexual immorality. We hallow God's name. We don't cheat. We don't steal. And two-timing and double-dealing and mean-streeting, another way of saying all those things, is not God's way. It's wrong. Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. May God reward him according to his works. May God reward some of the evil people in our world according to their works. That doesn't mean they're cast into the lake of fire. They'll have a chance. But they need pressure brought to bear. Now, let's look at the final question. How much of man's sins are the devil's fault? You know, is there a prayer for the devil? Is there hope for Satan? The answer to that is no. But how bad is he? Let's notice a couple of passages. Ephesians 2. And then Ephesians 6, but Ephesians 2 to begin with. Starting in verse 1, leads us into verse 2. And you, meaning the brethren, he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sins. And before we repented of our sins, we were dead. We were carrying the death penalty that we needed to have removed, and that would be through the Lord's goat, through the blood of Christ. In which you once walked according to the course of the world, according to the prince of the power of the air. For those brethren who were just called completely out of the world, that was the way it was. It may have been ancestors, you know, parents or grandparents now in the church in many cases. But at one point, your family walked according to the devil, prince of the power of the air, the spirit who works in the sons of disobedience. You know, he is responsible for this culture. We participated. He's responsible for it, among whom we all once conducted ourselves, the sons of disobedience, in the lust of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath, just as others. Why are people so unhappy today? Because they're children of wrath. They have a burning anger down inside, and they don't know where it's coming from, but it comes from the fact they keep breaking God's laws. That's one of the penalties of sin. And they could get rid of a lot of that if they just try to obey rather than try to disobey. Now let's go down to chapter 6 of Ephesians and notice verse 12. Because here we're talking about putting on the armor of God and resisting standing against the wiles or methods of the devil. And so in verse 12 it says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." That's who we wrestle against. And we think, oh, yeah, so what does that mean? You know, principalities and powers and rulers of darkness of this age and spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places or spiritual places. You know, it can't be that bad. Well, yes, it can, actually. Now we take ourselves back to Daniel chapter 10 for the example of the power of evil that works not just in individuals' lives and in family cultures, but in national cultures, and even international cultures. Daniel chapter 10. Third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. A message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belteshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long, and he understood the message and had understanding of the vision. And then Daniel comments further. It says, "In those days I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. I ate no pleasant food, nor meat or wine came into my mouth, nor did I anoint myself at all until these 3 weeks were fulfilled." It appears that he fasted for 21 days. You'd think we'd starve. Well, Christ fasted for 40 days as a human being. So did Moses. I believe Elijah did as well. You know, you probably had some supernatural intervention to, you know, in the body processes, but you felt the hunger for the full time. So 21 days. And then on the 24th day of the first month, while I was beside the great river, that is the Tigris, I lifted my eyes and looked, and there a certain man clothed in linen, whose waist was girded with the gold of Uphaz, his body like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like torches of fire, and his arms and feet were burnished bronze in color, and the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. And I was the only one who saw it, in verse 7. And it so terrified, everybody else ran away. Daniel was with a group. And he was the one that saw the vision. They must have heard the noise of it. And he collapsed face down, just collapsed down. And suddenly, in verse 10, a hand touched me, which made me tremble on my knees and on the palms of my hands. So suddenly he's in kneeling position on his hands and feet. And he said to me, O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have now been sent to you. And while he was speaking this, I stood trembling. So it's like touches him and he's on his hands and knees. And then suddenly he's on his feet. So this is dramatic intervention. This is an angel speaking to him, probably Gabriel, because Gabriel did come to Daniel on another occasion, and he is a messenger angel, whereas Michael is an archangel and a guardian of the church in the end of the age, and Satan was a covering cherub and probably also therefore an archangel before his rebellion. And that's the extent that we know. The biographies of the angels we know by name. Then he said to me, do not fear, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humble yourself before your God, the first day you started fasting, I was sent. Your prayer was answered. Your words were heard, and I have come because of your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. And behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. Now, a holy angel is sent to carry a message to Daniel, but the princes of Persia, they can't be human princes because he just walked through them. These are spirit beings. These are angels, fallen angels or demons, who are instigating and empowering certain kings of Persia, princes of Persia. In other words, behind the governments of this world are demons influencing and empowering them. And the demons have battles with the holy angels. It's also possible they scrap with each other because they live on hate, but we don't know that for certain. By the way, that'll be another piece of fairly interesting research we can do in the millennium to see what actually happens among the angels and what did this confrontation look like? Well, I presume that the audio-visual, shall we say, of history will be available to us and we'll be able to see it. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Then Michael came to help me, for I have been left there alone with the kings of Persia. Now, that's all done. We've vanquished them and they had to go away. I have come to make you understand what will happen to your people in the latter days, for the vision is for many days to come. And then what's going to unfold is chapter 11 and 12 and the vision there. So the angel had been battling the demonic princes of Persia and was helped by Michael the archangel. And the demons were the spiritual power behind the various nations, fostering and inciting every type of sin among men, including wars back and forth between them. So when you look at how much is Satan involved in the sins of mankind, he's involved in all the sins of mankind. I think it's very safe to say that. Involved in all of it. He carries as much or more guilt than us. You know, this is why he is called the deceiver, the accuser. That's what devil means, is accuser or slanderer. I mentioned that earlier. He's called a destroyer. He's the adversary. He is the evil god of this world. He is the father of lies. He is a murderer from the beginning. And that last part is from John 8 and verse 44. Those are not in any way complimentary titles. Those are evil titles of an evil creature, an evil being, and evil cohorts. So when we come down to the Day of Atonement and we reflect a little bit on this and sort of ramp up to it, we're humbled before God through fasting like Daniel was. And so we come under this because of that humility. It motivates repentance and helps us in that, helps us see the significance of where in our lives we're doing good and where we're doing evil and what we need to repent of. And then we, at the same time, we pray, like the high priest, a powerful imprecatory prayer that God will swiftly bring his judgment upon the devil. That's what the prayer of the Day of Atonement is. That's a prayer for the devil, that he will be destroyed. Now, he won't be annihilated and die, he's going to be locked up forever. He and the demons will be removed from the God's presence forever. As I said, he wants to make you think that mankind is going to suffer that fate in an ever-burning hell fire. Now, that's just a variation on what in fact is going to happen to the demons. Let's go back to our final scripture, which is in Romans chapter 16. Romans 16, right at the last part of it. Romans 16. The Apostle Paul gets back into the act here of the imprecatory prayer. And it is in verses 19 to 20. Paul is talking to the Roman brethren. He says, "For your obedience has become known to all. Therefore, I am glad on your behalf. But I want you to be wise in what is good and simple concerning evil." Not tempted by it in that sense. But you want to know what is good and what is evil and be able to identify them precisely. So you can speak against the evil and champion the good, in essence. But it's verse 20. Here is Paul's imprecatory smackdown. "And the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly." There is a longing for the Day of Atonement, that God will crush Satan under our feet shortly. An end of this, and the beginning.